Very good day to you. I'm Al Cresta. Thanking you for joining me. We've got a lot to talk about today, and I think you're going to enjoy the program. Of course, that's why we do it every day, because we think you're going to enjoy it. We certainly do. Why Joe Biden was denied communion. That's the topic coming up at 4:20 Eastern Time today on the program. We've sent out a little special notice reminding people of this because my guest, Dr. Ed Peters, an outstanding canon lawyer, is going to go over the reasons Biden was denied communion. I know most people would fill in the blank by saying, well, he was a champion of abortion rights. That's true, but there's more to it. And I think what Ed's going to share with us will help broaden our understanding of why this is an important and a very solemn decision that a priest must make. So that's coming up at 4:20 today. Also, we're going to talk to Reggie Littlejohn about China, what's happening there. Catholics in Hebei in China have barricaded themselves in their church. They did that last week in an effort to prevent authorities from tearing the church down. Now, there's been recently some new reports that the Chinese authorities are offering them compensation to build a new church that meets their requirements. We'll talk with Reggie about that. Also, Armenian Americans are grateful that the U.S. House of Representatives have approved a resolution that recognizes the Armenian genocide. This killed about 1.5 million people between 1915 and 1923. The Turkish government refuses to acknowledge the genocide. That's coming up. And then an hour with former Marine Sergeant Rocky Sickman, who was one of the 52 American hostages held for 444 days in Iran. We'll talk about the experience. It was very grueling, demanding, and we'll talk about what he's doing now. But first, to the headlines.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, November 5th. It is the Feast of St. Elizabeth. And today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria family of funds at AveMariaFunds.com. At least 9 American citizens, 6 of them children, and 3 women have been shot and killed in Mexico by drug cartel gunmen. Willie Jessup is related to the victims.
There were several families traveling to another community, and not very far out of Lamora, then their family came under attack, and there was a number of vehicles, 3 of them in particular, that were shot, and one of them was set fire.
The dead were part of a caravan of members of a Mormon settlement called Lamora, about 70 miles south of Douglas, Arizona, in Sonora State. Several other members were reportedly kidnapped after their convoy came under fire during a brazen daylight ambush. More than a dozen members of the decades-old settlement are missing and feared dead. Early reports indicated Monday's shooting was a case of mistaken identity, but the Klan has had run-ins with the cartel in the past after openly opposing local drug trafficking groups. Cal Fire is releasing more firefighters from the Kincaid Fire in Northern California as containment reaches 84%. More than 2,000 are still working the lines, but that's down from more than 5,000 when the nearly two-week-old blaze was roaring out of control. Full containment of the 78,000-acre wildfire in northern Sonoma County is expected Thursday. All evacuation orders and advisories have been lifted. However, the county health department says the burn area is toxic and dangerous, and its emergency order against property cleanup remains in effect. And U.S. officials are considering rolling back $112 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods as part of a Phase 1 trade deal. That would mostly include tariffs on clothing, appliances, and flat-screen monitors. President Trump has delayed imposing more tariffs on Chinese imports as talks between the two nations continue. With the Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Dan McGraw.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Well, the news coming out of China remains just very frustrating and bad. I mean, we now have Catholics barricading themselves in church to prevent the demolition of a church. This is a story coming out through Catholic News Agency November 1st. Priests and parishioners are barricading themselves in a Catholic church in the Chinese province of Hebei. According to reports, the Catholics are attempting to prevent the Chinese government from tearing down the church. We've also got interesting, we've talked about this before, but social credit-like measures are being used to suppress churches. Join me to talk about these problems is Reggie Littlejohn, founder and president of Women's Rights Without Frontiers. It's the international coalition to expose and oppose forced abortion, gendercide, and sexual slavery in China. You can follow her work at womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org, which we'll have linked at our site as well. Well, Reggie, by the way, great to have you back here. Thanks.
Well, thanks for having me back, Al. It's always a pleasure.
Tell me about this story. Chinese Catholics barricading themselves in church to prevent demolition. What's going on there?
Under the new, or not so new now, China-Vatican deal, which is secret, okay, no one knows what it says, the Chinese Communist Party has been using that deal to persecute Catholics and to demolish their churches. And in the beginning, you know, before this deal, only unregistered house churches like the Underground Church would have fallen prey to this kind of persecution. But now, under the new deal, which Pope Francis has said he hoped would unify the churches, what's happened is that even registered churches are being heavily persecuted. So this particular church in Hebei is a registered church.
Wow.
You know, they had followed all the rules. But what I learned from this woman that called me on right before the October 1st, 70th anniversary of the Chinese Communist takeover of China, is that she was an attorney in China, and she worked inside of the court system. And she said that inside the Chinese court system, the basic principle was that all religions, not just Christianity, but all religions are the opiate of the people, and they want to keep all religions small. And so they are systematically persecuting all religions. And so now, under this new Vatican-China deal, they are using incredibly small technicalities or even inventing problems in order to destroy churches. So in the case of this church in Hebei, they asserted that they didn't have the correct building permit. That's the reason they were tearing it down. The people in the church said they did have the correct building permit, but, you know, in the United States, if you don't have a correct building permit or if your building permit has expired, you go and get a permit. They don't tear your building down.
Right.
You know, and they're just using this as an excuse to tear down churches.
And the officials there are claiming that the Vatican supports them in this?
Yeah. This is because the deal is secret. And by the way, I call upon the Vatican out of mercy and even justice to make the terms of this deal public so that the Catholics in China can defend themselves and say, look, this deal has nothing to do with tearing down our church.
Yeah.
You cannot use this deal to say that the Pope said that it was okay to tear down our church. They need to see the text of the deal to defend themselves.
Right. Have they given you any response yet?
With the Vatican?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No, the Vatican has not contacted me either to tell me that they're going to make the deal public or to tell me they're not going to make the deal public.
Yeah.
But I think that
this is an important point. I think this is an important point, and that is that especially the people who are living under the arrangement need to have some feedback loop by which they can contact their bishops and also the Curia and Pope Francis himself, to say this is not whatever you if you intended us to flourish under this agreement, let me tell you, it's not happening. We're not flourishing here. And to me, the idea that they would be able to appeal to the Holy See, claiming that, yeah, we can knock down your church because Pope Francis signed this agreement, to me, yeah, well, let's see the agreement. Nobody knows what it says.
Right. Yeah, well, so the thing is, Al, that a lot of these Catholics cannot really appeal to their bishops very effectively because part of the agreement was the normalization of bishops that had been formerly excommunicated because China's government had been actually ordaining or consecrating bishops without the approval of the Vatican.
Yeah.
And part of the problem with the registered church or the official church is that the bishops and the priests have to be politically reliable. And so they go to communist seminaries, and basically they have to agree that the Chinese government it supersedes any Catholic belief, and they have to preach. This is one of the things about getting registered. They have to preach in a way that is consistent with the Chinese Communist Party being above Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's the way communists have to think about it. It looks as though there's been some concession to the protesters here. Are they now? Are they willing to compensate the congregation for the loss of the church? See, it's a Catholic news agency to that effect.
Right. So this is just this this report is just sort of hot off the press in the last 12 hours or something. But it says here, in an apparent concession to the protesters, government officials have agreed to provide a piece of land for the church to be rebuilt, as well as money to compensate for the destruction of the original building. I mean, okay. That's sort of like having your home destroyed and being compensated by being provided a different piece of land and money to rebuild. Everything you have thought was precious is still gone, and a huge amount of energy to rebuild. But the other thing is, Al, that this is what happens typically with the Chinese Communist Party. And I commend you and I commend the Catholic News Agency for reporting on this story, because what happens is when the international spotlight goes on to something, the Chinese government will make concessions because they don't want to be exposed as being the brutal totalitarian regime that they are. Yeah. And they will make concessions. And we've seen this in terms of women who are running from forced abortions, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'll write a story, or Congressman Chris Smith or somebody else will say, look what's happening with this woman, and all of a sudden the party backs off. But then as soon as the spotlight leaves, they don't live up to what they had conceded. So they're saying now, because everybody's looking at them, that they're going to give them a piece of land and money to rebuild. And it remains to be seen, you know, where that piece of land is. Maybe that piece of land is going to be so far away that no one can get to it.
Right.
And the compensation be completely inadequate. We don't know.
Right, right. And also, I don't know how it's going to be designed, right? I mean, who designs churches there?
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know?
Right. It could be designed where above the altar is a big picture of Chairman Mao or Xi Jinping.
Right.
The crucifix. I mean, if they actually do pay for this, that's a really great question. What's it going to look like?
Yeah, yeah. It's hard. I think it's hard for those of us who live in the United States to always keep in mind what it's like for our brothers and sisters in China. Those above in the above ground church and those in the underground church. Ten years ago, we were thinking that the situation in China was getting better for Christians. Since we've had new president Xi, things have gotten considerably worse. Why is that? What happened? How did he assess that he had to take a different direction?
Well, you know, I think that the totalitarianism of Xi Jinping may be a surprise, actually, even to the people within the Chinese Communist Party. So we understand the Chinese Communist Party took over China in 1949. They were never elected. They're not a legitimate government. But they had certain controls, like that they would have a new leader every 10 years. And all the leaders have abided by that. So Xi Jinping, for whatever reason, he saw his opportunity that he could reestablish his own power and become almost like a second Chairman Mao. One of the main things that he did was he abolished term limits. And so that he can basically be dictator for life. And I guess that he had terrified or terrorized enough people within the party that they ratified it completely with only two abstentions. So I think it's been a process of him just cracking down not only on Catholics and other religious people, but on people within his own party, that everybody there is terrified to oppose him. And so now he's establishing a totalitarian regime that eclipses anything in the book 1984. It's beyond Orwellian.
There's a standardized assessment they've got now. Which, you know, lists more than 50 violations for which churches can lose points. And then apparently if you lose enough points, you face various types of punishment. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. Okay, so we've spoken before on this show about the social credit system,
right,
where the Chinese Communist Party tracks individuals in every aspect of their life, and I can go into that if you like, and then assigns them a social credit score, and those who have good scores can do things like travel, put their kids in good schools, et cetera. Those who have bad scores cannot travel, they cannot put their kids in good schools, they can lose their job, they can be detained, you know, and then also the social credit thing is they use artificial intelligence and facial recognition software to track everybody's movements everywhere, all the time. It is truly frightening. So they have now started applying this to churches.
Wow.
And so instead of having an individual social credit score, the church will have an assessment score. And if the church has a certain number of points deducted, it's 20 points, they can be shut down. So again, this is just a way for the government to intrude to shut down churches.
Wow. How do people stay in touch with you, Reggie? This is stuff that we really need to stay on top of.
Oh, well, my website is womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org. That's womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org. And you can just get online and you can send me an email or subscribe to our blog and you'll be in touch.
Very good. Very good. Thanks so much. We'll talk again soon.
Oh, thank you, Alan.
Yeah.
Okay, take care now.
Reggie Littlejohn, again, this is, you may not remember, but Before 2001, you know, 9/11, it was largely thought that China was going to be the next big foreign policy problem we had. Well, it continued to be a problem, but it was displaced because of Islamic jihadism. Now we're back to China.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by a gift made from our day sponsor, Stephen Burley, in honor of his wife, Mary, who celebrates her birthday today, November 5th. Stephen says, "Mary is a blessing from the Lord and the love of my life." Happy birthday, Mary. You can be a day sponsor, too. Call toll-free 1-877-288-1077 and say, "I want to be a day sponsor." Food for the Journey's Sister Ann Shields on the struggles of compromising that leads to a failure of growing with the Lord.
Brothers and sisters, you really can make decisions that bring clarity. Don't just live with the status quo. Don't just say, "Well, this is the kind of person I am. These are my strengths, these are my weaknesses." It's fine to say that. But so many of us, I think, feel like, "Well, this is the way I've always been," or "this is my personality," or whatever. To excuse ourselves from confronting, am I really following the Lord, or do I have my feet in two different camps, the world and God, the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of the earth? Do I have my two feet in one place, or am I straddling? And if I'm straddling, you're always going to compromise. You're always going to try to find a way through that salves your conscience, but in fact, you're trying to serve two masters. And it won't work. So I want to urge you to take a look. Don't just listen to these readings and say, "Oh, I should think about this sometime." Think about it today.
Sister Ann Shields gives you food for the journey, weekday mornings at 6:45 and again at 11:30 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, many are concerned at the evangelizing methods surrounding the Amazon Synod. Evangelization is always a balance of culture with the gospel, and here, the Eastern churches can be very insightful.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Our individual and corporate relationships with the Lord, our relationship to the church, the precepts of the church, our relationships with the world and the culture that surrounds us. Father Ricardo discusses these things and more, all from the Catholic perspective on Christ is the Answer. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday evenings at 6, and Sunday mornings at 11 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
I'm Al Cresta. I promised last week that we'd spend some time looking at this incident in which former Vice President Joe Biden was denied communion at Mass for his public support and championing of abortion, as far as I can see. I said I wanted to have us hear from a trustworthy canon lawyer exactly what canon law says about denying communion to those unworthy to receive it. And we had an incident last month, maybe 2 months ago now, in Grand Rapids, where a young priest denied communion to a same-sex couple that had presented themselves. We're focusing right now, though, particularly on this incident with former Vice President Joe Biden. Helping us do that is Dr. Edward Peters, who holds the Edmund Cardinal Chaka Chair of Faculty Development at Sacred Heart Major Seminary, where he teaches canon law. You can follow his work at canonlawblog.wordpress.com. We'll have it linked at our website as well. Ed, good to have you here. Thanks.
Yeah, well, it's always a treat to be with you.
Let's talk about this thing with Joe Biden. This topic has come up for many years now, and it's difficult to find bishops who will actually support this. So explain to us exactly what canon law requires and then what canon law leaves, you know, to prudential judgment.
Sure. Okay. I think probably the best thing to do is to understand that communion, as we see it being done at Sunday Mass, let's say, that there's actually two actions going on. And so that we don't prejudice the discussion, I'm going to call that the communion event.
Okay.
But you notice there's two people doing two different things with two different laws.
Good.
You've got
okay.
a would-be recipient approaching for Holy Communion, and you've got a minister administering it. So those are the two different people. Those are the two different things they're doing, presenting themselves and then offering the Eucharist. Those two actions, Al, are covered by two different canons.
Okay.
And so you've got two people doing two different things that are responsive to two different laws. Now, you got to think that through, because otherwise it just looks like one thing. We see it so commonly, so routinely, we lose sight of the fact that there's different rules applying to the action of those two people.
Okay.
So the recipient coming up for communion, he's presenting himself. He is required to examine his conscience prior to approaching for Holy Communion. And if he finds his conscience wanting, if he's conscious of having unforgiven grave sin on his soul,
mm-hmm.
he's not to approach, period. He's not supposed to go up there. Now, that's an internal forum assessment made by an individual would-be recipient, perhaps with advice from a confessor, although I think if, you know, in most cases, a confessor who got that far with someone would say, listen, why don't you just confess a sin and we'll be done with this.
right.
But sure. Yeah, but you've got, there's where the internal forum, the examination of conscience, takes place. It takes place in the recipient. Now, you've also got a minister of Holy Communion, and he is not judging consciences. He can't do that. He wouldn't, but he can't anyway. He is instead looking at objective behavior. Now, in the vast majority of cases, as we all know, there's nothing obviously wrong about, you know, some individual coming up, oh, maybe if he's wearing a Nazi uniform or something like that, right, we'll say, right, okay, there's a problem of disposition here.
Mm-hmm.
But in the vast majority of cases, the minister of Holy Communion just sees an individual standing in front of him, and he gets to presume that they have examined their conscience, etc.
Okay.
But there are some cases that we know about through the media, through public statements, through public records, and so on, particularly, let's say, with the example of highly prominent, nationally known Catholic politicians whose behavior, not their conscience, whose behavior makes them ineligible to receive Holy Communion, makes the minister, puts the minister in a position where he's required to withhold the sacrament. That's what we saw going on with Biden last week.
Hmm. So in that case, the key word here is that the minister of Holy Communion is required. Is he required to protect the sacrament or to protect the spiritual well-being of the intended recipient?
Well, you can make the case for both of those,
sure,
and you can add a third, in
okay,
fact. Because the minister isn't judging consciences,
right,
he's not totally sure whether the person has, completed all the requirements for a mortal sin and so on. He doesn't know if he's fully aware of the evilness of his action, whether he chose it freely, whether he might have repented. All that stuff is very important for a pastoral, a spiritual director and an individual recipient, but it's irrelevant to the minister's question. The minister just wants to know whether there is public evidence, manifest evidence, that this person is engaged in behavior over a significant period of time that is rejected, condemned by church moral teaching, etc. Okay, that's what he's trying to assess. And in the case of a prominent national, many decades long Catholic politician, their records on abortion and other issues, but abortion is just so crystal clear,
right,
open and shut. We all know, any thinking Catholic knows that's gravely evil. We can tell from their public record that they have consistently supported this, endorsed it, maybe even more recently, as in Biden's case, are seeking to expand it, to enshrine it in legislative acts,
mm-hmm,
and so on,
mm-hmm,
that the minister can say, you are engaged over a period of time in objectively evil behavior. I cannot give you Holy Communion. And the two canons we've been talking about, it's canon 915 and 916, both of which are in the code and easily available online.
Ed, let me ask you then, because this, you explain it with great clarity here. Why? What's the reluctance then of priests and bishops to act as straightforwardly as this one fellow did in denying communion to, other,
right,
that well-known champions of abortion?
Right. Well, I think a couple things impact these guys, ministers in particular. First, we could say, look, there's going to be some close cases. You know, depending on what stage of Biden's career you're talking about, I mean, in some decades ago, you and I remember him as being, kind of, sort of pro-life.
Right, right.
At what point does one cross the line? Well, recently, certainly in my opinion, Biden crossed the line. But
mm-hmm.
So you're going to have a few difficult cases, but to actually have to withhold Holy Communion from someone kind of goes against the grain of what priests and ministers of the Eucharist, want to do.
Right.
They want to share the body.
That's right.
They remember Francis and a string of theologians behind him saying, this is medicine for the spiritually weak, etc.
Yep.
So it kind of goes against their personal preferences and so on. And their spiritual sense, I guess, to actually withhold Holy Communion, because it's kind of a startling thing, which is why this only applies, this rule of 915 only applies for public acts. I think that's another point we need to be clear on. If an individual is known, objectively known to the priest, let's say, to be engaged in private sinful behavior, unrepentant sinful behavior, and they present themselves for Holy Communion in a public setting like Sunday Mass, even though the priest knows this person has unrepented, objective, grave matter on their soul, he's going to give them communion.
Interesting.
Okay? Because the action that would otherwise disqualify him, the recipient, is not publicly known. And you can look at Thomas Aquinas, you can look at Felix Capello, my favorite canon lawyer on sacramental law. They all say, no, if it's merely private sin, no matter how grave, one is supposed to administer Holy Communion. I'm sorry, but that brings us to the third point that I meant to finish on the third, that yes, you've got concern for the sacrament, yes, you have concern for the soul of the recipient, but you also have concern for the community. And that's where the element of scandal comes in, classical scandal. If it is known that a Catholic politician is consistently supporting abortion, again, just to stick with the clearest example, then, and the community knows that, then giving communion to him is inevitably seen as the church, if not endorsing his abortionism, at least saying it's no big deal,
wow.
you know. So you've got three things. You've got concern for the dignity of the sacrament, concern for the soul of the recipient, and I think underestimated in all this is concern for damage to the faith community, which inevitably occurs when public sacraments are given to publicly known people in objectively sinful behavior.
Well, so the three S's, concern for the sacrament, concern for the soul of the individual, and concern for scandal in the community.
I'm using that, Al. That's great. That's a nice, concise way to put it.
I was going to say, you could have been a Baptist preacher with those three S's like that.
I like it. Yeah. No, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly the threesome.
Okay. We had this one incident in Grand Rapids, too, which had to do with a same-sex couple. Subsequently, the priest wrote to the congregation and said had it to do over again, that he would have met with the couple privately twice, and only upon the third time would he have withheld communion. But that raises the question in my mind, then. A same-sex couple, right? Is that a public? Is that well known publicly? In other words, how well known does something have to be? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't have the facts of that case.
Right. And I don't have them in detail either. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if they had gone through a civil wedding ceremony, if that was part of the fact pattern, I think that's a public act.
Okay.
That's what triggers withholding communion for divorced and remarried persons,
yes.
That their public status under civil law, which is information available, and it's usually known in the community that people have gone through a civil wedding.
Right, right.
The public status of that civil legal act is what makes it manifest to the community. Now, if you've just had a couple who happens to be homosexual, who happen to be living together, and so on. That's a gray zone because, you know, there's lots of reasons people of the same sex might be living together.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
I wouldn't take pure cohabitation between people of the same sex as objective manifest grave sin. I just wouldn't. But
right.
Going through a civil ceremony, if that was part of the facts up there, then I would have accepted that as a public act.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Ed, thank you so much. This is most helpful.
Okay, Al.
And we'll talk again. Thank you.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Dr. Edward Peters, again, you want to follow what he's doing there. Canonlawblog.wordpress.com. I mean, that's as beautiful and concise a presentation as I've heard on this. So, again, we'll have a linkage for you, of course, at AveMariaRadio.net. I'm Al Cresta.
Are you tired of investing in the culture of death? Would you like your investments to be in line with the Catholic Church? Would you like an advisor who is a fiduciary and who understands retirement issues while sharing and respecting your Catholic beliefs? Contact Joseph Vitale at American Retirement Advisors at 855-756-5700. Helping you preserve your retirement while preserving your beliefs and values. Call Joe at 855-756-5700.
In July of this year, the California Court of Appeals handed down an important decision in a case we were litigating on behalf of our pro-life clients. The three-judge panel unanimously ruled in our favor, holding that a restriction on pro-life signs because they were grisly or gruesome violated the liberty of speech clause of the California Constitution. At issue was whether the Irvine Company's speech restriction prohibiting grisly and gruesome imagery as applied to restrict our client's abortion-related imagery violates the free speech provision of the California Constitution. Unlike the First Amendment, which only applies to state action, under the California Constitution, large shopping malls are considered public forums for free speech, and private entities, such as the Irvine Company, may be liable for violating California's liberty of speech clause. The trial court upheld the Irvine Company's speech restriction, but the California Court of Appeals reversed, holding that the challenge restriction is content-based and does not survive strict scrutiny review. This is a huge and important victory for the right to free speech. Indeed, there is hope for the free speech rights of conservatives when a California appellate court upholds the right of a pro-life organization to display abortion imagery in large private shopping centers under the California Constitution. I'm Robert Buse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Father Larry Richards spoke to the men's group at St. Patrick's Church in Brighton, Michigan.
Bring the kingdom of heaven, not out there, but in here. But that'll cost you your life. Christianity in these last 20, 30 years have become wimpy for men. You know, you become effeminized. You know, we make Jesus, oh, Jesus was so nice and gentle. And we picture him tiptoeing through the tulips. You know, his la-la. But Christ was a man who laid down his life. Who said, I'm going to have to suffer and I'm going to have to die. And if you and I are going to follow him, we're going to have to suffer and we're going to have to die.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Father Larry Richards came from Erie, Pennsylvania to Brighton, Michigan to talk to the men's group meeting at St. Patrick's Church. We'll hear his mass homily and talk on our next program. Listen to Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is Evidences for Christianity. New Testament critics claim that the similarities between stories and the Gospels is evidence of collusion, and therefore the Gospels are a fraud. But if that were true, why are there obvious differences that real collusion could have covered up? For example, at Jesus' tomb, was there one angel, as recorded in Matthew, a young man, which we find in Mark, two men, so says Luke, or two angels, as in John's account? Differences like these are not contradictions, but strong evidences that over the centuries, the different accounts were held in such high esteem that the Gospels have not been fixed. A fact that only adds to their credibility. And that's evidence for the authenticity of Christianity. To explore more, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved Resolution 296, which recognizes the Armenian Genocide, which killed 1.5 million people between 1915 and 1923. Now, this has been, you know, a genocide which has become very politicized, especially for countries looking to improve relations with Turkey. Joining me right now to talk about this is Dr. Ronald Suny. He's professor of history at the University of Michigan, where he was the first holder of the Alex Manoogian Chair in Modern Armenian History, also founded the Armenian Studies Program. He's the author of They Can Live in the Desert, But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide, and serves as chair for the Society for Armenian Studies. Dr. Suny, good to have you with me. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Most people are not especially familiar with the facts and circumstances surrounding the Armenian genocide. And normally when they hear about it, they wonder why it is that this is not part of our working consciousness in the United States. Why has the story not been told over and over again, or at least received acceptance over and over again?
I think there's two reasons. One, long time ago, yep. And in a far distant place in eastern Turkey, in the old Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. So it didn't hit Americans directly, at least for a long time. Even though the American ambassador there, Henry Morgenthau, was sending dispatches back and wrote a book later about it. So it was somehow forgotten. And the second thing was it's actively denied. The Turkish government, unlike, let's say, the post-war German government, never recognized and systematically denied that anything like a genocide took place.
Right.
They claim it was a rebellion by the Armenians, which is untrue, a kind of civil war, and that there were no deliberate policies by the Ottoman government to destroy, massacre, assimilate, disperse the Armenian people of the Ottoman Empire.
What did the Ottoman government, what was the objective? What did they want to do? Why did they want to do this?
The government of the Ottoman Empire at that time were the people we call the Young Turks. Mm-hmm. And they had what you might call a modernizing agenda. They wanted to make their country, which is already well known as the sick man of Europe,
right,
a more powerful state, a more united state. And they feared that the Armenians, who were a very educated population, had been fairly successful in business. They were, much of the middle class was Armenian or Greek or Jewish in this largely Muslim empire. They were fearful that the Armenians were getting too much power, too demanding in their requests for rights and protection in that period. And then, worst of all for them, for the Turks, it seemed, European powers, particularly Russia, but also Britain, sought to protect the Armenians and use the Armenians in a funny way as a wedge into the internal policies of the empire and said, you, Turkish government, you've got to reform and you've got to give these people protection. And that very much created resentments, fears, anxieties among the Young Turks.
Hmm.
When the Ottoman Empire went to war with Russia and Armenians found themselves on both sides of the front, that only heightened the anxieties of the Young Turk government, who feared the Armenians might rebel and go over to the Russians. In fact, what is often not recognized is almost overwhelmingly the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire fought for their empire against the Russians, while Russian Armenians on the other side joined in volunteer units against the Ottomans.
Yeah.
So the Armenians were in a really difficult position. The Turks, after losing a major battle in the winter of 1914-15, turned on the Armenians, blamed them for their defeat, and then began systematically to massacre them.
Armenia, I think, was the first formally Christian country in the West, 300 AD. Are Armenians generally strongly Christian in their orientation?
Armenians, in fact, we like to say that Armenians were the first Christian nation in the sense that their king, even before Constantine and the Roman Empire, recognized Christianity as their own national religion and began converting pagans into Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been Christians since the early 4th century, which wasn't exactly a comfortable position to be in when by the 7th century, Muslims began moving into the area. And Armenians found themselves on the very frontier between Christendom and Islam.
Yeah.
And they've been in that area. But the ones that we call Armenians are those who survived and who maintain their Christian church, their separate faith. Armenians have their own church, the Armenian Apostolic Church, sometimes called the Gregorian Church, and they survived to the present time.
The House of Representatives voting, again, overwhelmingly to approve this resolution. A resolution like this seems to come up every few years. Has it generally always been turned down, or is this a real breakthrough?
This is a breakthrough, and Armenians are quite happy about this.
Okay.
Basically, every person who's run for president, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, Obama, etc., all have said, once I become president, I will recognize that in 1915, 1916, hundreds of thousands of Armenians were massacred at the hands of their own government. We will recognize it as a genocide. And then as soon as they get into office, they forget about that. And the resolutions fail usually in committee.
Yeah.
But we had a particularly interesting moment, historical moment, because the United States had been allies with a very democratic and progressive group of Kurdish militants in northern Syria, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces. And then President Trump decided to withdraw American troops.
Right.
Remember this at the beginning of October.
Sure, sure.
And allowed the Turks to invade that area, drive out the Kurds. And this event not only shocked most of the military and political establishment, but Democrats and Republicans as well. And because Turkey has been so reckless in its policies and ruthless in its policies, and because this ethnic cleansing of Kurds, who had been our allies from northern Syria, so reminded people of the events of 100 years ago, that 405 members of the House, against 11, voted for the first time in history to recognize that 1915 was a genocide. So it's an extraordinary breakthrough. It wouldn't have happened without this moment of deep, deep antagonism toward the current policies of President Erdogan and the Turkish government.
Isn't that something? Well, the Turkish government has often been considered an ally of the United States, and so we've used them to get supplies into Iraq during the Iraq War. President of Turkey, Erdogan, has been suspected of wanting to move closer and closer towards some sort of Islamicization. Do you have any doubt that Erdogan is trying to Islamicize Turkey?
Turkey is already almost overwhelmingly an Islamic state.
Well, yes, I know in terms of population, but in terms of policy.
Right. Yeah, no, there's no question that Erdogan would be interested in enhancing the role of Islam in Turkish culture, which was heavily secular for a long time, when the older regime, the regime that he's replaced, so-called Kemalist regime, was in power. Mm-hmm. And he's moved in that direction, which has created a lot of resistance, particularly in the cities, because people there are more European-oriented, more cosmopolitan, and they don't want to have those kinds of Islamic restrictions in their daily and public life. Right. So he, in the last election, he lost the mayoralty races, all the major big cities in Turkey, and which may be one of the motivations for this turn to war in Syria. It's always good if you're losing popularity at home to launch a nice war and get everyone rallying around the flag. We know that from our own history.
Sure.
So this may be part of what he's doing. But his major conflict, and this is the bizarre part that people in the West may not understand, is with the 15 to 20 million Kurds who are also Muslim who live within Turkey. And those people are not given rights. They cannot study in their own Kurdish language.
Hmm.
Their mayors have been forcibly removed from office after being democratically elected. I was in Kurdistan not long ago, and people there talk about this place as a colony. They use the word sumerge, which means a colony. They are occupied by the Turkish government. And I've been in Palestine as well, where Israel occupies the West Bank. And I had the same feeling. These people are under the thumb of a regime which does not want to give them the rights and the possibilities for a free life that they so desire.
Wow. We talked about this slaughter of the Armenians back 1915 to 1923 as a genocide. Explain why that word is important.
The word genocide is one of the most powerful words in our vocabulary. And every nation seems to want to have some claim that they suffered a genocide, and it's amazing. In order to be a nation nowadays, you need an army, you need a bureaucracy, you need an opera house, and you need a genocide. I don't mean to be flippant, but it's as if the word has lost its meaning.
Yeah.
The word itself, as defined by the United Nations, and I think it's a very good definition, is a particular kind of crime against humanity. A genocide occurs when a government decides to eliminate a cultural, religious, ethnic group. So it is not just the killing of people. That occurs in all kinds of different ways. But it's the killing of a people. It's when the government decides this cultural, ethnic, religious group is to be eliminated, to be reduced to insignificance. You don't have to kill all of them, but you remove any possible potential for their claim to political and social and cultural rights. That happened in 1915. So the Armenian genocide was recognized by Raphael Lemkin, the very person who
right.
Coined the term, along with the Nazi Judaicide, the Nazi genocide of the Jews, as two of the major genocides of the 20th century.
Do you have any confidence that the Senate will also pass a resolution, a similar resolution?
This House resolution is in itself a big deal. That is, it is a non-binding resolution by one of the two houses of Congress. Now, the Senate could do that, or it could just neglect the issue. They have a lot of things on their agenda now. But people are angry. Congressmen, senators angry at what the Turks have done. They feel great shame that we had these allies, these faithful allies,
right.
The Syrian Kurds, who lost 11,000 men and women, by the way, it's a very feminist state as well. 11,000 people died in our struggle against ISIS. We lost 11.
Right.
They lost 1,000 times more. And so the breaking with them, the betrayal, is so shameful that maybe this will inspire people in the Senate, which is controlled by the Republicans at the moment, to take up such a resolution.
Yeah.
I'm not confident that will happen. I'm hopeful that it will happen. Yeah.
You know, I remember after the first Gulf War, there was also concern that George H.W. Bush did not follow through with support for the Kurds afterwards. I don't know if the expectations were too high, they wanted a separate nation or something. But I do remember there was discussion about our not making good on at least implied promises to the Kurds back at the end of the first Gulf War. Is there a long history of the United States treating them poorly?
Not only treating them poorly, but this kind of betrayal. We've done it several times.
Yeah.
There was a time when we were supporting the Kurds in Iraq because we had problems with Saddam Hussein
right.
and so forth.
Yeah.
And then we gave up on them. This was the time of Henry Kissinger. And this was back in the 70s. And the Kurds were betrayed. Saddam Hussein later gassed the Kurds in that area. There was another time after first Gulf War when Dick Cheney was in the first Bush administration, again, there was killing of Kurds. And it became so public at that point that the United States had to create a no-fly zone. And the Iraqi Kurds now have a kind of de facto autonomy within Iraq.
Mm, okay.
That's the kind of thing that the Syrian Kurds were hoping to get. And, of course, the Turkish Kurds would love to have as well. They've been largely battered and defeated in the last decade. So this kind of betrayal of the Kurds is standard because they're inconveniently placed geographically.
Right.
Armenia, Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. And none of the governments of those countries want to give them the kind of recognition and autonomy that would allow this people that numbers something like 30 to 40 million, we don't even know, their own autonomy, if not state.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Sunni, thanks so much for being with me today. I hope we can call on you in the future. This is very helpful.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
Dr. Ronald Sunni, professor of history at the University of Michigan. I'm Al Cresta.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com.
Fire on the Earth's Peter Hervek on the diminishing influence of God on our culture and ultimately in us.
One of the reasons why the church today is not having the impact it can have and should have is we've accommodated too much to the culture. Sunday has just become another day. The whole culture has just sort of transformed it and said, hey, there's nothing special about it. Now, the world is going to do what the world's going to do. But Christians have to be wise and not be conformed to the patterns of this world. That's a pattern in this world that's destructive. It's destructive because, one, it offends God, first of all. God says, keep holy the Sabbath. Keep holy the Lord's Day. And so many people have stopped going to church. Why? Because they're just busy. Why? Doing what? Playing golf, watching sports. Jesus loves our sentiments and our feelings, but he also looks at us seriously and says, do you seek to obey my commandments? Where are my commandments in your life? Are they a burden? Are you afraid they're going to take away your fun in life and are going to ruin your weekend? Do you resist them? Or do you hunger after them? Are they a light for your path?
Peter Herbeck spreads fire on the earth, weekday mornings at 6:30 and again at 11:45 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Well, let me thank you for being with me today and reminding you, as always, a few books that we talk about on this program are available in the online bookstore. So we'll have Dr. Ronald Suny's book there for you on the Armenian Genocide. Coming up next hour, we're going to spend time with former Marine Sergeant Rocky Sickman. It's a remarkable story, so stay with me. It's about his 444 days as a hostage in Iran. I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.